Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money and helps you understand how both digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas Groß and today I'm joined again by our guest host Jonathan Noll from Etonic. Hi Jonathan.
Hey Jonas, great to be back for another episode of our digital money interview series.
Yes, and we have once more a very exciting guest. We are speaking with Christian Catalini. I'm sure most of you have heard of Christian. He was a key architect of the Facebook-initiated Libra project that actually inspired this podcast. So the first episode of this podcast was on Libra and I think the next 20 as well. And afterwards, we just broadened this a little bit up. He also worked before as a head economist for Meta, recently also worked on Bitcoin as co-founder of Lightspark, advises various companies in the space and is the founder of the MIT Crypto Economics Lab. Also writes regularly on Forbes, both digital money, AGI, or some other topics that Christian thinks are relevant and very excited.
Yeah, that's right. I had a great pleasure working with Christian at the ill-fated Libra DM project, which we'll get into in just a few minutes. By far one of the smartest people I've ever met. And as you pointed out, he's been leading really the thinking around digital money and AGI and many other areas. So, hey, Christian, welcome to the show. Great to see you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with both of you today.
So, you know, let's jump right into Libra. We're recording this on June the 3rd. So there's some interesting developments that's happened. So I think we can kind of double click on that. But let's kind of go to the beginning. You obviously were a core architect, as Jonas mentioned, one of the co-founders of Libra. I think a lot of people didn't realize it was incubated at Facebook for a number of years before it saw the light of day in June of 2019. Talk about how you got involved in it, what excited you about getting into the Libra project originally.
Yes, as some of you may know, I was kind of one of those crazy early academics that got interested in crypto. I actually arrived at it through crowdfunding. I'd been studying kind of crowdfunding platforms since 2006. This was way before Indiegogo, Kickstarter, any of the US ones really emerged. It was actually a Dutch platform that was first. It was called Salabend. Nobody remembers it, but it was essentially this glimpse of how do you democratize access to funding, access to capital using the internet. From there, you know, stumbled on Bitcoin. And then in 2013, my first year on the job at MIT, we designed the Bitcoin experiment. We gave everybody about a third of a Bitcoin, which, you know, today's worth a lot more than that. That was kind of my official entry down the crypto rabbit hole, and then spent my time really trying to unpack what are the economics of the technology, where is it going, what is the arc. That ended up, you know, leading to a trip, which I thought would be a research trip to Menlo Park. David Marcus, who at the time was still at Messenger, was putting together what became the founding team of Libra. I joined the trip thinking, okay, maybe we'll do something similar to the MIT Bitcoin experiment on Facebook or with a subset of the, you know, the global audience that Meta has, and ended up, you know, leaving with, okay, should I drop my academic career and jump into tech to convert the ideas behind crypto into reality, or should I not? Of course, I decided to do that. Otherwise, I would have probably regretted it forever. Joined the founding team of Libra. Then, of course, you know, we also met Jonathan through that journey. We made so many mistakes throughout that. Lots of scars, lots of learnings, too many regulatory meetings, pretty much every central bank in the world that matters. We met with every three or four letter agency across the globe, wanted to hear from us or grill us, depending on how you want to think about it. The project eventually, you know, wrapped up. Its legacy, I think, lives for sure in one place, which is the Genius Act. The Genius Act has essentially enshrined the reserve design that we had come up for with Libra, a lot of the protections that we had envisioned during the Libra days. The project folded, but I think its legacy continues in strange ways. Today, while we're recording this on June 3rd, there's rumors of a new stablecoin consortia with the likes of MasterCard, Visa, Stripe, and Coinbase. If true, and again, this is still a rumor, but maybe by the time the podcast goes live, we'll know a lot more. It feels very Libra-esque. It's almost like a core subset of the Libra initial partner set. So as I tweeted, you know, a few hours ago, you can kill a project, but you cannot kill a thesis. There's still room for more neutral stablecoin provider that can bring together a number of different participants. I think it needs to be neutral. It needs to be grounded in interoperability and openness. Some of the leading providers, I think, of course, want to claim victory already, but the space is wide open. I think you're seeing lots of new coins entering the market, shaping the trajectory of what's going to be the future of fintech. So super exciting time. Clarity Act kind of coming close to the finish line. That after a long back and forth between the banks and the crypto sector, not surprisingly, the debate was all about the stablecoin yield. We can double click on that. But fundamentally, you know, the banks are coming. The banks are going to embrace tokenized deposits. The banks are ready to play. They understand that the technology, unlike during the Libra days, cannot be stopped this time. You know, we were stopped also because of our own mistakes. But fundamentally, I mean, the arc of technology eventually wins. So looking forward to, you know, unpacking more of this with all of you.
Yeah, just a great interesting that happens to me today as we're recording that's happening. It sounds so very familiar. And of course, they have the advantage of, you know, looking at what, you know, was done at Libra and maybe different ways and different timing, right? The regulation, as you mentioned, is in a different, very different spot right now. But, you know, democracy is hard. It'd be interesting to see how they do the governance. But we'll look at that probably in another podcast. So looking back at Libra, what are you particularly proud of in that? Because there were so many different concepts in that, both from a technology standpoint, but also from an economic point of view, from a governance point of view. What do you look back now at from your view as a co-founder to say, wow, that's the part of the thesis that we got right?
Yeah, I mean, ironically, the technology was state of the art, but ended up not really mattering. I mean, it's been available as open source. Some teams have built on it. But if you look back at the last decade or so of crypto, we clearly crossed a moment where the technology was not the issue anymore. And that was probably way earlier than people realized. We still have a cottage industry of layer ones. New ones are being proposed. I think some players have been trying to push their own layer ones to kind of reshape the space to their liking. But really, the innovation here has always been about governance. And as we, I think, witnessed also through the Libra experience, it's extremely difficult to build true distributed governance. It's nuanced. You have to get it right. And you also have to get it right in terms of timing. Many projects probably decentralized too early. And so then they're left with kind of the situation we had where we really had, you know, more than 24 members with one vote. As Jonathan knows, when we would go into those voting moments, we would not know what the outcome could be. Now, people always assume that, okay, Facebook as the leading anchor sponsor of the project had disproportionate influence. It didn't. And by the end, you know, the Libra Association under Stuart Levy was completely independent, had its own executive team, had gone through a bank-like application process with FINMA and Switzerland. So it was ready to be a truly global payment system that could be neutral and independent from Facebook. But nevertheless, I would say the contributions, if you put aside the tech, which again ended up not mattering as much as we thought, are probably in thinking through what makes this system scalable and safe. So a lot of the work that, you know, we did at the time with my co-founder, Zaim Asari, who used to be at Davis Polk, one of the top law firms in the country at the time, and then eventually joined the founding team of Lightspark. Those rules and pieces of the puzzle that regulators wanted to see, boring acronyms like PFMI frameworks and rules, the reserve design, right? So I had a whole team of top economists that we had put together that engaged with some of the best macro economists on the planet to think through what does the Libra design have to look like to scale to billions and then trillions of dollars. We also spent a lot of time on things that never surfaced the day of light, but I guess we can talk about them now, how to incentivize properly different participants. And it's not as simple as making sure that everybody has upside and is paid for performance. As you know, all of these consortia that have been proposed over the years and these even stablecoin consortia eventually really struggle with scale up. Everybody's kind of waiting and seeing for others to do the right move. In Libra, we had spent tremendous amounts of time on the market design and the incentive for merchants, wallets, ecosystem participants, and really ensuring that that ecosystem could grow and thrive. And by the way, could grow and thrive in a way that wasn't unbalanced. Something that kept a lot of us at night was, how do we ensure that, you know, this doesn't just collapse back into the Novi wallet, the Facebook wallet? It needs to be a vibrant ecosystem where there's true openness and ability to compete. We wrote a piece about transitioning Libra to permissionless that was released with the white paper. It didn't get probably the attention it deserved. We really believed in making the network truly decentralized and having that progressive decentralization be a part of it. I understand why nobody believed us, which is probably fine. We made a number of missteps, even in how the project came to market. Marketing and the announcement was way too loud. It was scary, right? It immediately created a sense of threat to the incumbents, to the governments. People started thinking that the Libra basket, which was really designed to essentially be more international, right, and more stable than any single currency, people saw it as a competing unit of account. It was not meant to be. It would have never been. When we talked to the central bankers behind the scenes, they admitted that. They knew exactly that it wouldn't be a threat. But then, you know, the politicians were good to spin that into this massive looming threat. The real threat has always been technology that lowers the cost of what people are used to paying for today, whether it's payments, financial services. That's happening irregardless. AI is only going to accelerate it. So again, to summarize, key legacies, I would say the economic design of the reserve, the protections on the legal side, you know, the consumer claims. How do you ensure that you will get your dollar out of a reserve of stable coin? We've seen the DPEG during the Silicon Valley bank run. These problems were not theoretical. Thinking about how do you fit a stable coin into Basel III, into that framework with operational risk, market risk, credit risk. So there is a lot more in Libra behind the scenes. I'm sure all of these new stablecoin efforts will have to rediscover them, especially with Genius. It's an exciting time. But again, I think the legacy was mostly ideas. And those ideas are probably stronger than any individual project.
Before we jump back into today's episode, a quick word about an event close to our hearts, the Point Zero Forum, an annual gathering of over 2,000 policymakers, central bankers, regulators, and industry leaders at the intersection of finance, technology, and policy. BFRR is proud media partner of the Point Zero Forum, and we'll be reporting live on site with the full co-host team. Organized by the Global Finance and Technology Network and the Swiss State Secretariat of Finance, the Point Zero Forum takes place in Zurich from 23rd to 25th June 2026. This year's lineup includes Swiss Federal Councillor Karin Keller-Sutter, Teva CEO Paolo Arduino, former crypto head of policy at Andreessen Horowitz, Brian Quintens, and NVIDIA's EMEA financial technology lead, Dr. Jochen Papenbrock. The agenda covers everything from AI in financial services and digital assets of stablecoins, tokenization, and the new regulatory frontier where the rules of finance are being rewritten. Come meet us in Zurich. Register at pointzeroforum.com, and as a BFRR listener, you get 30% off the full price industry pass with code BFRR2026. I repeat, BFRR2026.
Yes, and even if it didn't launch, you know, such an outstanding impact, like as you said, Christian, like if you look at the stable coins today, a lot of them look very much inspired from Libra. The regulation definitely is in Europe and the US, I would say as well. And I personally really enjoyed, like, I remember when I read these papers and I was still quite, you know, early in my PhD journey, I was, you know, kind of really in love with the concept in terms of like this multi-currency basket, which just is just so super stable, and also making the system decentralized. That sounded so perfectly to me, right? But as you said, it was somehow something that I think on paper also the multi-currency setup was super smart, super good. But as you said, it, together with the marketing tone, which was about, hey, we reinvent money, didn't really resonate very well, I guess, with all the central bankers you talked to. And maybe looking back as well, Christian, as a last question of Libra, like, You mentioned a few mistakes like marketing, etc. Is there anything more, like what you would ask some of the key things that maybe with the knowledge you now have, you would have done differently so that Libra maybe would have seen daylight?
I mean, some of us were advocating for something much smaller, right? So why don't we launch a small remittance app, allow people to move money cross border, show utility, no big, you know, loud announcement. And for those of you that remember, Libra launched, you know, out of the San Francisco Mint. So very iconic place, no reinventing money slogans, like something that could have incubated a bit more under the radar and shown the world that, okay, this is something that adds value to consumers and businesses. And so therefore needs the right to exist. I still remember this meeting in DC where we were actually meeting with FSOC, which is essentially the firing squad of every regulatory agency in the same room. And when we were leaving that room, somebody from the government approached us and they told us, don't Uber us. I didn't know it was a verb in DC, but it turns out it is. The idea being don't launch and then kind of apologize later. We did go through the motions of, you know, I think engaging with regulators extensively, professionalizing the association and everything around it. I mean, Stuart had been at Treasury, so he had all the right experience for turning this into like a bank-like institution. In the end, it didn't matter. So I would say, you know, if you look back, again, launching with a much narrower, smaller project and iterating around it, always great advice. Probably ejecting the project out of Facebook earlier on, which is something that, for example, some of us really believed in, would have been better. And it's fascinating, right? Right now, you do have efforts like Stripes with Tempo, Circle with Arc, that are kind of following in some of those footsteps. And I think depending on how they play their cards, they'll either survive or die on the idea. Some of the parameters I think were right. The timing was probably very, very early and very wrong. That's probably the hardest one to undo. And then the other one was like, no network of this type can win without ensuring that the incumbents are sort of part of it. As much as we love to tell stories about disruption, look, one of the things that killed Libra was very active lobbying to Congress and officials against it from people that were really worried about losing payments to tech. So I guess we were very, very naive.
Yeah. But as I said, you know, you did, even if project didn't launch, I think you would really not perceive this as some kind of failed project, because, I mean, on the paper, it probably would, because it's not launched, right? But all the impact...
No, we failed. Let's okay, be clear.
So you would
we
say
miserably
you failed.
So I don't want any confusion on that. We failed.
Okay.
It's on us. I think, you know, there's a lot of things that if I could repeat the history from the beginning, I would do differently. We also learned a lot. And I mean, to some extent, Lightspark was born out of some of the lessons from Libra. Of course, there's always new lessons. And so the space has evolved again very rapidly. And so it's kind of surreal now to see it all swing back to kind of some of the concepts and ideas of Libra. I guess in a sense, it was inevitable.
And hindsight is always 2020, right? So you can always look back and say, would have, should have, could have. Yeah.
I don't know. Some of the mistakes were very clear even during the day. There were just, you know, different opinions about that.
Let's now also, Christian, come to the topic of AI and AGI, right? Because that's one of the topics where you're currently doing a lot of research. For example, wrote a recent paper, which we will also link in the show notes, Some Simple Economics of AGI. Well, in terms of simple, I'm not too sure if it is, you know, depends on how you define simple.
That's a trick, you know, to get people to read it.
But maybe, you know, kind of high level, I think what the paper like explores is what happens when AI can basically generate almost unlimited work and intelligence, but humans remains limited in their ability to verify what is correct, safe, and also trustworthy, which, I mean, I think you currently have also at this point in time already, because you get AI outputs everywhere and reports of 50 pages, and then you have to do something with it by yourself. So often you throw it back into AI, or you say, well, I'm not doing anything with that. So I think that's from a daily life, a very relevant topic, and maybe just very, very high level. So starting in slowly and easily, like, what would you say at high level in practical terms, what were kind of the key findings of the paper?
Yeah, maybe just to set the stage for why we decided to write it. What I got really passionate about crypto back in 2013, economists always cheat when they're faced with something fuzzy, fast-moving, uncertain, like AI right now, they try to boil it down to fundamentals. Sort of first principles, you can think of it that way. So we did that exercise back around 2013-14 for blockchain. So there was a, some simple economics of the blockchain, and some may even remember an earlier, some simple economics of crowdfunding. Same lineage. I try to write one of these every 5 or 10 years. It became really clear to me about a year and a half ago that everything that was accelerating on the AI side was existential for every startup, every business, every individual. And I think, I mean, I wasn't alone on that. A lot of people have recognized that. And so I went through the same exercise with my co-authors, and where we wanted to really land is, can we build a basic blueprint for what's still defensible, what's not defensible, what will AI take, what will humans kind of defend, and what's worth spending time on? Right now, you know, I'm now part-time on my own startup and thinking about what's worth maybe building next. And so I wanted to first go through the exercise to realize, you know, where is this going? And it's extremely difficult to do at this stage because it's moving so quickly. I mean, those of you following the recent developments, every few months, you know, model capabilities change, the debate shifts from what's actually a risk versus not. And so the paper tries to really start from a very basic idea. The idea being that if you can measure something, if something can be captured in numbers, it will be automated. Now, I can tell you if it's going to be automated in the next 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, but fundamentally, anything that leaves a digital trail or can be captured by a device, a screen, whatever it is, will be subject to AI automation. So if you start with that belief, which, by the way, we checked with a number of computer scientists and they tend to agree, then, you know, you're left with the residual. What is not automatable? Well, it's essentially stuff that hasn't been recorded yet. Think about all the knowledge that each one of us has in their brain. From birth, you know, you see all sort of events, your weights get calibrated, your neural net, you know, gets fine-tuned over time. And those weights are yours and yours only. So when presented with the same information, you will process it differently than an LLM. You will process it differently than a different person. So what you're doing there, when you're, for example, looking at AI output, you're doing verification. You're essentially comparing that output, whether it's a piece of text, a song, a piece of code, against what you believe is good output. And of course, in a moment where AI has captured all the nuance of what's actually in your brain, then the gap between humans and machine is gone. There's no difference, and the AI can fully replicate what the human would do. But for most domains, we're still seeing, you know, senior expertise to be really valuable, possibly more valuable than before. And so a lot of the doomerism around all the jobs will be gone, I think is misplaced. There's going to be a painful transformation in between, and people will need to reinvent their jobs, reinvent where they add value, how they allocate their time. But fundamentally, that human act of, some people call it taste, some people call it curation, some people call it judgment. I think all those terms are cope. They're too ill-defined, they're too vague. They don't force you to essentially define what is the residual. But once you start thinking about it in terms of like what is measured by the machine versus what is measured by humans, that gap is all there is. And so what we call verification, we believe, first of all, that verification is the bottleneck that's left. Of course, there's still bottlenecks in energy, compute, you know, all the atoms that need to be used to power the AIs, and in robotics, of course, building those new devices. Those are real physical bottlenecks. But the meta bottleneck is really verification. You're already seeing this playing out live, right? So many companies are building these harnesses and set of skills that combine with a model, make the model a lot more predictable, reliable. In fintech and financial services, just to give an example, like Catena, right? Which is a bank for agents built by one of the co-founders of Circle, Sean Neville. Their entire predicament is companies will want to use AI agents, but how do you put the right guardrails? How do you ensure that they're following rules? How do you ensure that, you know, they're essentially behaving the same way their treasury, compliance, or regulatory team will want to? Those additional guardrails are essentially verification. Often for verification, we still need a human in the loop. In some other cases, you will not need a human in the loop. Countless of examples. If you look at all the startups that are doing now legal support, there's been a lot of, in the last few months, right, a lot of debate around, will the legal profession be automated? Well, as it turns out, the expertise of a senior partner, it's what's going to make the difference on that last mile. So AI, like crypto, as a last mile problem, and the last mile is called verification.
Yeah, I think that's, there's just so much in that. I mean, it's a very long, very deep paper, the simple economics of AGI. But, and I love a lot of the terms that you guys have come with, the hollow economy versus the augmented economy, the measurability gap, which you're talking quite a bit about. One thing I found really interesting, because I've thought a lot about this, because I have two daughters that are going into the job market soon, right? The missing junior loop, right? Where this idea that, oh, isn't it great? We're going to get rid of all the entry-level jobs. And all I can think of is, how can that work? You can't go to school, get educated, and start as a senior manager. You need that process of learning, making mistakes, learning from those mistakes, and kind of going up there. So maybe double-click just a little bit on that missing junior loop concept.
Yes. So if you think about that measurability gap, the models today have ingested everything on the internet, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of books and other materials. That's often the package that, you know, a recent graduate comes out with. They have not encountered the friction of the real world. They've studied on books. They've done classes. Academia is still, with some exception, is pretty bad at giving you that more practical applied knowledge. Now, ironically, I think there's a long history, for example, you know, in Germany about technical schools that really create the craft. But fundamentally, most young graduates are at a comparable level, beyond their latent intelligence, of course, and their own talent, than an LLM. And so what you're seeing right now is that a lot of these entry-level jobs seem to be in less demand. Now, I don't think we have the precision and data to make a clean causal claim that it is AI-driven, but clearly many tech companies are looking at the problem as if the organizational structure will change over the next few years. Jack Dorsey wrote, you know, some long tweets about how he's redesigning Block. I think there's been a number of layoffs at tech companies. Now, the bulk of that is bloat. These companies have been overhiring, even through COVID. They've had layers and layers of management and additional staff that is probably not needed to begin with. But I do believe there's also a seed of many of these top CEOs that have been really AI-pilled, realizing that, oh, I can restructure an organization around very new constructs. I can run with less people, more talented people, flatter organizations, and get more stuff done with less, you know, politics and layers. So that part, I think, is here to stay. And what that means for young graduates is, I mean, here's the bad news. The bad news is that the career path of the past, where, you know, you graduate, you get an internship, and you progress through a certain career, it's gone. Maybe it never existed, but it's definitely gone now. And you're also more threatened because in that initial phase where you haven't done your apprentice, whether you think about, you know, resident medical doctor, or young lawyer, a summer associate lawyer, or an IC4 coder in a tech firm, again, you're very similar to what the AI can do. So you're kind of substituted away. And AI can be cheaper than that. But the upside, and this is why I think all the doomerism is wrong, is first of all, I mean, we've talked all extensively with Jevons paradox. AI lowers the cost of intelligence. Think about software. We're going to use a lot more software than before. But the bigger piece of news that I don't think people are talking enough about is that those same tools are the tools that can help a junior really master and get to excellence way, way faster. If you look back at all of our, you know, early days, we would have loved to have these tools and accelerate on whatever career or interest or latent natural talent we would have had, right? So people can discover their own true self and professional talent way earlier. They can essentially become masters way faster. You don't need the, you know, what is it, the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of mastery, right, to become truly proficient. The tools are there. I think we haven't built the right tools probably, and education will have to be rewired and reinvented for this new context. But, you know, to your young children approaching the job market, I would say it's mostly good news. It depends on the attitude you take the problem on. If you're like, oh, you know, recent, all the commencement in the United States when commencement speeches mentioned AI, they got booed. That tells you something about the sentiment and how lost this generation that was first hit by COVID and now hit by this wave of AI feels. I think that needs to be acknowledged and recognized. But we also need to send the message that things are going to be much better. Just look at some of the recent scientific discoveries in medicine, in science, in math. We're entering an accelerated phase of human progress. There's going to be painful transition in the middle. We have to accept that, you know, some things that used to be true are not true anymore. But I do think that the glass is half empty, if not three quarter empty. So the tools are amazing. They give you superpowers, but you kind of have to roll up your sleeves. And as Karpathy has said, I think a couple of days ago, you have to get sweaty with online learning, right? Online learning cannot just be, you know, cannot just be entertainment. Learning with LLMs needs to be sweaty. You have to get your hands dirty. You have to struggle with the problems. LLMs can make your problem super simple. They can solve it for you and you're not going to learn anything, or you can use them as a learning tool. And that's kind of the future.
And Christian, also coming like back to the topic of money, right? Because from, I think what you said, like everybody can, you know, take some of the lessons on what you said and can, you know, can embed this into the thinking, because there was really some practical advice. But what I'm now wondering is, what does this now mean for money, for payments, for Bitcoin, for stable coins, right? Does this relate? I guess it does, because, you know, you love both topics in this sense, and probably it's, you know, also some crypto elements there, but how are they? So maybe you can shed a little bit light on the role of crypto, stable coins, money, and all of that.
Yeah, let me start with kind of what's happening before AI, and then we can layer AI on top. So first of all, it's very clear that we're now in the mature phase where things are going to get done. Genius Act, Clarity Act. I mean, when the US starts leading with clear guidelines, a lot of the rest of the world follows. No offense to Mika, but fundamentally, you know, this is going to be a massive accelerant for this space, and a lot of institutions have been waiting for this to happen. Yeah.
And at least it was easier for the United States to draft the regulation due to Mika, right? So at least this helped.
Yeah, I guess. Although, you know, again, Genius inherits a lot more from Libra than from Mika, luckily. Look, I think the reality is that the digital asset space has a couple of years ahead. They're going to be about execution, enterprise sales, bringing the technology that's already established into the mainstream, making those user experiences more useful, making them disappear in the background. Consumers may not even know that stablecoins are involved or tokenized deposits. They will just see faster, cheaper, better payments. And look, often people push back and say, well, we had SEPA Now and UPI and PIX, all these systems for a long time. Yes, but those are all domestic systems. They're very limited in what they can do. They essentially do payments. You cannot do programmability on top. You cannot really, you know, connect an agent to it. And so I think we're going to see a whole wave of innovation. It's like taking what crypto has done over the last decade and making it actually real and useful. I think that's happening. When you layer AI on top, it's very clear to me that, and in the paper, we talk extensively about strategies for startups, for incumbents, for individuals, even for policymakers with respect to all of this, where you can add value changes. A lot of fintech is somewhat protected because of licensing and regulatory red tape. The models cannot yet go and have meetings with regulators on your behalf and get you licensed. So I think there's a bit of a moat there. But if you look at what's been happening over the last few months, you have companies that have reinvented themselves as AI first companies. Of course, Stripe has been on that trend for a while, but also Ramp and others. What they're doing is they're taking their fintech experience, their fintech data, and now expanding really rapidly in other areas of software. So I do think that especially in the digital asset space, it's a time where incumbents will thrive and they can do a lot more faster. Incumbents used to be slow, clunky, had a lot more fragmented, siloed systems. But even GSIBs, if you think about some of the world's largest banks, they're not building massive digital asset teams. They're going to play a role, right? They're not going to sit on the sidelines. They're not ready. There's a really interesting tension, I think, brewing between stable coins as bearer assets that deliver full interoperability on one side and tokenized deposits. Tokenized deposits, of course, are a lot more economically efficient. They could move trillions of dollars of value out of the bat. I mean, the banks can essentially come together on a clearinghouse and yeah, boom, you would eclipse the TPV of stablecoins today when it comes to real payments on day one. I know Europe is betting more on that model. I think we're going to see both try for different reasons. Lots of interest around all sort of tokenization and new assets coming online because of tokenization. I do think that when it comes to tokenization, to some extent, you know, tokenizing something that's already existing, it's less interesting to me than tokenizing things that didn't exist before. Typically, that's where the weirder, more innovative stuff comes from. Think about the internet. A lot of the home runs and Web2 companies were not things that were obvious translations of what we had before, but completely new concept. Think about social media, right? And so It's a fascinating phase, but here's the threat. When you look at the foundational labs, their capabilities, Anthropic recently, did a deal with FIS. They also released a number of skills. These skills, replace a compliance officer or other steps in the financial services flow. Now, it's not a full replacement just yet, but you can see where this is going. OpenAI on the consumer side, launching the finance app, trying to get into that financial advice, curation at the consumer level. All very interesting, different bets. You can never count out Google. Google as being kind of leading back the charge with some of the best models in the space. And they do have, plenty of TPUs to scale. So of the hyperscalers, they're probably one of the best position to keep going. You have Elon coming back, to X. It probably needs original vision, ironically, the early PayPal. And so I would expect more from that team too when it comes to money, payments. They have one of the most vibrant and creator communities online. So look, I think it's a time where you cannot count out anyone that's building a foundational model, because they will play a meaningful role through the supply chain.
What's also interesting, and I think we've seen this now in Money 2020 from Amsterdam, that also, like, who was it, ING, Worldline, and I think MasterCard or Visa, right, also did announce something together on the AI front and basically, show a great UX and say, look, this all works on existing rails, right? But if I understood you correctly, Christian, you're really of the conviction that in the end, the underlying infrastructure for payments in the topic of agentic will be around blockchains for a lot of the use cases. Did I get this correct?
Yes, 100%. I don't think that rules out the incumbents. Often people jump to the conclusion because it's going to be on crypto rails, the credit cards are doomed. Not yet, right? And in fact, many of these are embracing agentic, they're embracing kind of all the right things. Ironically, the history of disruption, if you look historically, the MBA class case that gets always talked is the one about the disk drive industry. And people always forget to tell the second part of the story, which is like, take Seagate. Seagate is still dominant. In most cases, the incumbents that know what they're doing and know how to rally their resources fight back. Think about the music industry and the debt of the music labels. The best music labels are more profitable than ever before. Some of them own even a share like in Spotify, right? So they position themselves right.
So no Ubering here.
I think that's hard. Now, that said, again, stablecoins have done a lot for financial inclusion. If you think about the rise of Tether, why is Tether so successful? Is because it gave access for the first time to millions of people around the globe to something that looks and feels like a bank account. It's probably not the same as a bank account at JP Morgan, and it will never be, probably. But what's kind of interesting is that maybe that was the first phase, and now, the big guys are coming into the room. You're going to see stablecoin issuance. If this rumor about a consortia with those names is true, with MasterCard, Visa, Stripe, Coinbase, then that's kind of it, right? In a sense, now you have some giants pushing a shared open, stablecoin standard. That could be really powerful. Again, it depends. Well, what's the level of openness? Is it more like Circle's arc, where Circle has a lot of design decisions over the entire ecosystem and is clearly trying to, work around the fact that stablecoin issuers are hardly profitable if you're only making money on the reserve? That's kind of a missing historical artifact of it. And it's one of the reasons why, when I saw the announcement around Tempo, I was like, they're following in many of the footsteps and some of the mistakes that we did with Libra. How do you really convince the world that the ecosystem is truly open and competitors can come on with trust, right? So that's been the challenge of crypto ever since.
Let me ask you, I'd be remiss in not asking you this because of your background, because you're an economist, because you're a European living in the U.S., and I'm originally from the U.S., living in Europe. How do you think about, currently stablecoins are all USD, 99 point whatever, 9%, 5%, whatever the number is. Do you think the stablecoins will reinforce this dollar dominance globally? Or is it going to eventually sort of weaken the power of the nation states over money? Where do you think this lands from your sort of economist point of view?
Yeah, I've had a contrarian thesis on this for a while, and it's mostly shaped and inspired by Libra. when we were, you know, pitching Libra or describing Libra to regulators worldwide, there's a lot of pushback around dollarization, around, you know, big tech entering a country and becoming foundational infrastructure. The same way, if you think about messaging, right? So apps like WhatsApp or Messenger are pretty much the bedrock of many countries' infrastructure, whether they're used in healthcare or other systems where essentially everybody is messaging and transacting information through these platforms. The reality is right now, you know, dollar dominance is really strong, but it will reallocate to a much more natural balance. Think about, you know, the share of the dollar in global trade or cross-country interactions. So somewhere maybe between, depending on how you think about it, maybe a low bound of 65 to 70% to a high bound of 80, 85%, somewhere in that range. We will need domestic stablecoins. I think they're going to be a critical piece of the puzzle for the benefits that many of us in crypto have been describing for a while. You need to be able to go from currency to currency seamlessly with an atomic swap. It means you need the stablecoins. Now, the good news is that all you need is one good player in every region. If that good player has good banking integration, then the magic can happen, right? Everybody can interconnect and this will unfold. I think Euro stablecoins have been punching below their weight for two reasons. One is the regulatory red tape and the design of MiCA around it. It's too heavy. It kind of cornered some of the stablecoins in a position where probably they're not as competitive as they are in the United States. That's part one. And it's a bit of a pity for Europe in general when it over-regulates regulates too early, to be honest, nascent technologies. There's also, I think, within along those lines, broader public sector opposition to the entire concept. I mean, you've seen Christine Lagarde's recent statements. Europe still doesn't seem to get it, which is painful as a European, that this technology is here to stay. You can try to put the genie back in the box, but you'll end up with a very clunky system. And second, are companies really allowed to experiment and scale these use cases? At the end, what will make stablecoins successful is treasurers that want to move money 24/7 between different countries, companies that want to do import-export faster, cheaper, of course, also the cross-border money movement and remittances. But all these applications that really benefit from interop will be really important. I do think eventually a piece of agentic payments will be naturally on stablecoin rails, not all of it. You know, a lot of agentic commerce for retail, that's going to be kind of your credit card, your payment processor. They can do a really good job of that already. So I don't think it needs crypto behind the scenes. But more generally, for Euro stablecoins and other domestic stablecoins to thrive, you need a vibrant fintech ecosystem around it. And so probably that's the biggest problem. I know there's really talented entrepreneurs and companies in Europe. But again, maybe it was Draghi that had the clearest vision of what Europe needs to do to compete. It's funny because I think Europe has all the answers, but somehow nothing ever gets done. And so maybe we'll take AI, like some major AI shock as we get closer to AGI. To unlock things, but it's painful because Europe has so much talent from science, technology, to really entrepreneurial individuals that want to build things, and the red tape, the bureaucracy, the policy is really what slows you down.
Yeah. And also, like, for the listeners, we did take a look at Lagarde's speech and also some MiCA news in the last episode. So we will link this as well, the last news episode. And I think, Christian, so I totally echo, like,
we need a younger guard in power in Europe. You know, I think there's a component of, like, to understand the technology, you need people that have been living and breathing it at an earlier age.
Yeah, maybe we have to apply some, you know, young economists to get into the position of Lagarde, who knows. But I think, you know, I echo also, like, this red tape and that MiCA is somehow very restrictive. What I tend to interpret currently as positive news is that there will be a MiCA 2.0, and there is currently a consultation going on by the European Commission, actually asking the market, now also giving actually 3 months time to provide feedback of a lot of questions. But yeah, I just hope this, you know, results in a better MiCA 2.0 and not in an even more complex MiCA 2.0, because I absolutely agree, Christian, with the potential and also the role of the euro can play. If we play the cards right, we did not play all the cards right yet, but potentially can. Maybe to wrap this up, Christian, before we go into the kind of outro, as like a last question. We talked now about stable coins, you know, role for agentic, also about Libra, and you also interestingly worked a lot on Bitcoin in the Lightspark role, for example, right? You mentioned that it's about, you know, financial inclusion, programmability, interoperability, modularity. I think we got, you know, we got out of that that blockchain is super important, also stablecoins are. But what's your perspective on Bitcoin in particular? So is there also a use case for Bitcoin, or is this, you know, all taken over now by stablecoin as a payment use case and that's kind of it?
Yeah, and look, maybe you know, some of the ideas even of Lightspark were too early. And we may go through a phase where some of these consortia or other chains will be dominant at first. I do think eventually it'd be very ironic if all of the effort of crypto would land back in curated closed or semi-closed networks. I hope we don't. So I do think that even on the regulatory side, regulators should ask for interoperability. They should ensure that the spirit of the technology of truly open, permissionless networks is preserved. In that universe, you know, you could see networks like Bitcoin and Ethereum playing a leading role, or Solana and a few others maybe. When it comes to Bitcoin, the asset, I've always thought of it as, you know, not a hedge against inflation. I think that narrative is not corroborated by data. It is kind of a high beta tech stock. It's a bet on new infrastructure. And if you look at it, it moves that way, right? When there's been tightening, it goes down. When the markets are risk off, like right now, Bitcoin loses a lot of its value. But it is the first time in history that we do have this unit of account that, you know, doesn't depend on any central bank, any financial institution. I mean, that's truly novel. That's likely here to stay. That said, it's technology, so people can always come up with new constructs and new ideas. Right now, a lot of people are worried about quantum. So it would be great if the crypto community took that quantum threat more seriously. I think there's paths for upgrading all of these networks to quantum resistance, but it needs to be done. More broadly, I do really hope that on the other side of this transformation, we end up building the financial sector on more open primitives. After all, I think that's what AI agents will want. And you know, since they'll be our overlords, maybe they'll drive it in the right direction. But it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. That said, I do think that some of these efforts, if you look at even Tempo and these other groups, or maybe this new stablecoin effort, if true, that is rumored today, do really have a shot at changing the world. They have a shot at lowering costs, at delivering a lot of value to consumers and businesses. At the end, that's really what matters.
We need to be nice to our overlords. That's a lesson learned.
Always say thank you in your prompts.
Hey, Christian, this has been great. We could go on for hours, but unfortunately, we're running out of time. I know you have a hard stop as well, but it's been a great conversation. Been very enlightening, mostly enlightening, sometimes mortifying, as the Chinese curse says, may you live in interesting times. but really appreciate you sharing.
It's all good news. There's no time for AI doomerism. I think we need to stop propagating that. The technology is going to be amazing, but we need to step up.
No, I totally agree. I like that. I like that analogy you talked about. Just, you know, you gotta put the work into it, right? It's not going to just happen automatically. But thank you so much for being on the show today and sharing your thoughts and your wisdom and your optimism about this brave new world of AGI. For anyone listening, we'll include links to Christian's work, some of the topics we discussed in the show notes, and thanks for tuning into the Digital Money interview series on Bitcoin, fiat, and rock and roll.
Thank you very much.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.